The class I visited today here read my novel, Ava, and a book that chronicles the last day of a woman's life. Her name is Ava Klein. She's 39. She's a professor of comparative literature and a child of survivors of the Holocaust. Many of her family did not survive, and the victim now of a rare blood disease. She is also filled with an inexplicable and ravishing joie de vivre. We talked about that a little bit earlier. In the pages of the Bay of Angels, Ava will make an appearance, and so that's why I am most interested to read from that today. We find her in this book at an earlier stage in her illness and at a point where she is in the hospital receiving a bone marrow transplant. Less serene than on the last day of her life, and probably more actively suffering. She is working constantly in order to survive at this point. And so there's a different engagement, and the form is different. We were talking about form and content before, but she'll appear in a different sounding way because she is at a different place, and it is earlier in her illness. I don't think I need to say much more for these excerpts to make sense. Both pieces I'll read two pieces today, are narrated from her hospital room. She's either awaiting or it is just after her bone marrow transplant. Here she remembers her third husband, a teenager from Spain. And in this recollection, the body is failing, but is called back to vibrancy, though not without premonitions. There's an epigraph, and the epigraph is, generally speaking, a body can be ignited but once, whereas a body may be brought to a state of incandescence many times. C. Tomlinson, 1838. I'm in my green velvet dress again, with the streamers at the shoulders in the ballroom turned crimson at the Machado House, where we have come to honor the great writer and statesman, Señor M. Dignitaries have gathered, among them the Countess Cristina Leonora and her teenage son. There is a profundity to the body and a madness. Oh, someone sighs, there's Carlos making his usual entrance. Who is that? Ava inquires. Oh, no one important, Ava Klein. And half your age, by the way. He appears to be bleeding, having somehow cut his hand on the punch bowl. Rather dramatic, don't you think? And now coming this way. Green, how much I want you green, he says. He turns to me in my dress with streamers. A wind moves through the body as if through olive trees. He limps to the periphery. God knows why he's limping, holding his reddened paw, and I follow, drawn irresistibly to this bleeding Spanish saint reciting Lorca. I secure a linen napkin as a bandage. There is a profundity to the body and a madness. It harbors darkness, sadness, bells, a strange joy, deep song. The punch bowl shatters, something is lit on fire, the distinguished writer speaks, confetti and birds fall, champagne floats by in flutes. I'm alive for a nanosecond on this beautiful burning earth. In the cloud forest, the abyss of tears, the gardens of lamentations and ecstasy. His blood blooming through the linen and ice scooped from the silver bucket, and already I am burning under his bleeding hand on this spinning earth. His body makes the room, drenched in red, spin. From the body emerge larks, nightingales. From the body, longing, deep song. Emanating from the body, the scent of jasmine and wolves. Green, how much I want you. The body grows wings, sings in new languages, creates philosophies. The body retains what the mind lets go. As one wakes heavy, leaden, having forgotten the tragic news in the night, the body recalls, harbors ruins, sorrow, keeps what the mind cannot. I'm alive for a nanosecond. I am alive and burning under his bleeding hand. But he's barely half your age, obviously a teenager, Ava Klein. Is that what he is? For I have not dared look at him. The hairs on my arm stand on end, and there is a low call from the small of my back, and already I feel him brushing up against me, but so gently as to be imperceptible, as if a kind of torture. Look, it's the Countess now, coming in for the kill. Not even you, Ava. Whispers in the room, and a scarlet scrim descending. The Countess comments on my green dress. That particular shade, quite interesting, pulling her son away. He turns to me, his blood gaze blazing, and wordlessly we leave the room, knowing things as only the body can know them. I dreamt we were alive. How many times after would our blood bloom as on that first night? I dreamt of the passage of the moon. I dreamt of the passage of the moon across the sun, the violet shadows and the birds quiet and the darkness and the weeping body and the body that each night voyages beyond the boundaries of the body. It is not infinity, but it is something like it. That expansiveness, that awe, impossible to fathom. The words blur and the feelings grow more and more imprecise, yet more intensely felt. Those fugitive nights, all the molecules of the body opening onto wonder. Viewed now as if from afar, the mortal blood rising in a red mist, ascending like the ruby-hearted Christ on the third day, and now staining the wild green where they find themselves. As he fastens her to a tree, her body birds. He tells her of the seven-hearted boy, the seven petals, the insomnia of the horse, the prayers in unison, the mute one, the body with wings, the transfigured night, the asphyxiation, that sublime descent. All is measure and recklessness. And her safe word, choose a safe word, her safe word was green. When the objective all along was that he take her to the speechless place, the mute island, where no word, safe or otherwise, could be uttered. Carlos adjusts the ropes, the stirrups, the blindfold, the leash, the pale blue scarf, the tether, leaving no room for doubt or margin for error. My safe word was green, a word to be uttered to indicate too much or too far, a word for stop before wordlessness. Just a little bit more burn at the place the body ignites. Floating lanterns illumine the night, and her body at last sails into the darkness and the stillness. How to describe the feeling? Have no fear, I'll be going far off like an echo. I'll be going far off in a boat with no sails and no oars. And what is this taste for oblivion, for nothing more and always with him? Carlos singing at the place of horses and skulls, take the scissors. This theater of the utterly absurd, we were all too happy to perform. The body in plaster of Paris drying, a kind of cast. Few points of entry. It's like a comedy sometimes, is it not? And what is the thing, unknown, indecipherable in her, that he brings up so urgently? This longing for both being, for living, and for nothingness, for erasure, for oblivion. She thought is what one body might do to another, instill in another. A taste develops, a predilection, and they marvel at the body's intelligence, the body's instincts for survival and annihilation, and how he opened whole worlds, this most unlikely boy, and more than anything, I wanted to be opened. The jet of blood, the mystery of pulse, vertigo, the dark philologies of the body, as Dali had said, the central fire, the funnels of night, the body when pressed, when pushed, when adored, when deprived, floods with beauty, nostalgia, memories, and the small child she was, her fingers on the piano keys, a whole octave in green light, the tree leaves pressed up against the music room window. Blindfolded, she ponders the gift of sight, the voracious, insatiable eye. In the soundproof room, she hears things. The goddess melancholy is black. Her light is all inside. The body wails and keens, green, how much I want you green. The body dwells in darkness, profundity, deep shadows, an eerie silence, the wind all of a sudden come up. All this, long after it passes, the body shall retain. Not an animal moved, and the birds went quiet. A solar eclipse, during which the Countess Christina Leonora, assuming herself exempt, looked directly into the black sun and soon went blind, her retinas singed. And though she could no longer see, it was revealed shortly thereafter that she had in the process somehow acquired the gift of second sight. To announce this to the world, she held a formal dinner at the Rochambeau House. I can see the future, she declared, and the first thing I have seen is this. That woman, pointing to me, is soon to die. It is evident in her face. This uttered about Ava Klein, not yet 30, and in the peak of vibrancy and health. Look, she declares, as if it were proof. The black dog that never leaves her side, and the stillborn child. Slit your throat now, Juan Carlos, the Countess instructs, because your bride is doomed, and she will cause you only heartache. I see it clearly now, as if it has already transpired. You are following the beer in your blocks, so dapper, my son. Bereft, wrestling with ghosts, he weeps. Against the door now, he's placed an alarm clock, a grandfather clock with a crown that chimes, an egg timer, a pocket watch. When the hour strikes, he begins his rituals to the chiming of blood and bells. the tolling of bells and blood, the body's desire to transcend its verdicts, its dark archive, alive, the fury and rapture that lifts us up into the air, the seething creature we make, the clocks unwind, suture me back together now, resurrect me, retrieve me from the dead. Black iris, black hollyhock, black horses, a procession. Birds fall now and hail. The real and the unreal mingle in a shattering of falling stars. The body is placed in a wooden box. The bones go to earth. The body underground under the impossibly garish weight of the gladiolas. Sigh. There's a skull, an apple, a horse, a still life, and a clock. The darkened drapery, the mossy wings, the cat is blue and trust. She's seeing things. For the body, as much as you try to negate it, returns. The body and how it resisted their foolish games. The death charade they were lucky enough to stage for a time. And yet, was it not a rehearsal in some way? The body is a boat, a dirt road, a begging bowl. The body houses the bells and the death knell. We stand before the black paintings. Do you know what Miro said on his deathbed? He said, "I want to see the dog of Goya." We stand before the dog. There is not a single Spaniard who does not pray before it, who does not lay prostrate. His wounded hand, poor paw, she had said to the creature. There is something monstrous about him, don't you think? In the way children can be. That beautiful bleeding boy will make the light shine through. With brilliant and sudden splendor now he has returned from out of the obscurity and the distance and the years. He lifts us into the air, levitates us into the air once more. The body's late hallucinations, the body's resourcefulness, the body's profound attachment to aliveness, carrying ruin and feeling beauty, the blood vessels to my hospital room, the hummingbird heart, the wing beat. And who now cannot think of the Countess when I am diagnosed with a rare blood disease? And then sometime after that, when it becomes evident that an intricate and risky procedure would be necessary, the nurses swoop and dive. This should not hurt too much. The vulnerable body, the porous body, the body of uncertainty and roses, our pure perishing, the disembodied, bloodied paw floating in the room. I'm in my velvet green dress again with the streamers at the shoulders. The dead wear mossy rings. The dead wear mossy wings, the Countess Leonora said absently, staring at the black sun. Now that the body betrays, now that the body poised at the edge of the abyss, or so it seems, appears to be failing, that once unflappable body, the one thing that could always be relied on, the way it lit up in the dark and the way it went far and then too far, swoop and dive, they take the vital signs. And it is true. The more the body was canceled or erased, the more she wanted to live, and her resolve grew despite her death foretold. She remembered it from here, a world of pure vibrancy and form. She cries out, "Green." He genuflects before her, small deaths all around them, and confetti barely perceived in the distant sound of cheers as if from a faraway bullring. The matador, so small, a small red speck from the blur, confined, the body rises, and there is no rising like it, and there is peace a while. A wistful dark angel, bodiless, now presides. But it is not your time, Ava Klein. There's no hurry. It's all right. The angel will wait as long as it takes to escort you back to vapor. The longing of the angel around the bed, the desire to have a body, it would do anything for one, for it would be a privilege simply to feel the way the flesh presses against earth, the way the blood from a gash flows warm and red, the way breath like wind inhabits the chest for our instance on earth. Your safe word, inaudible. I can't hear you anymore. Inside the body, birds fall now, a black dog, a stillborn, perfectly formed, and hail. A girl playing a piano at her first recital, a big bow in her hair. The white ox passes through, and the moon, and the dead wear mossy wings. The cat is blue and trust. She's seeing things. There is a profundity to the body and a madness. It holds, it harbors darkness, sorrow, beauty, joy, melancholy, wonder. He's back, his red gaze blazing. I am alive for a nanosecond. And without a word exchanged, we leave this stark white room together, knowing things as only the body can know them, imagining the wings I will soon leave on the sheet. So that's Ava thinking about Carlos. And again, a nod to Brad. It was published originally in Conjunctions and is forthcoming in the Best American Experimental Writing of 2020. This next piece as well was published originally in Conjunctions and reprinted in Harper's Magazine. I decided to read it in part today because of something I read in the paper recently, and it reminded me of this piece a little. It's impossible, of course, to keep track of all Trump's outrageousness, and this one may have passed under your radar, maybe not, but here it is. In a 7-page draft executive order obtained by the Chicago Sun-Times, Trump declares that the federal government since the 1950s has largely stopped building beautiful buildings that the American people would want to look at or work in. Future federal government buildings, he decrees, should look like those of ancient Rome, Greece, and Europe, and so on. So this piece came to mind. It is still Ava. She is still in her hospital room. She has just had her bone marrow transplant, and she's very, very ill, and it's unclear what will happen next. As I, Ava Klein, lay dying, I happened on my travels to encounter a young man named H. At first, I would see him only on occasion, but after a time, he seemed to pop up more and more, and I must say it became something of a game to anticipate where I might spot him next. I did not dread these sightings, as one might suspect. He did not appear as an apparition of terrible consequence, but rather merely as a young man of ordinary attributes moving with a certain purposeful stride through the last city, or holding court in one of the cafes, or sitting silently on a bench in one of the majestic darkened parks, or, yes, there he is now under a green awning at the Chat Noir, nearly obscured from view, drawing. He is always drawing, it seems, and I have become curious as to what consumes him so. taking a seat next to him, I see that this morning he has drawn a woman's foot, a proscenium arch, a cupola, an urn, a balding head, a dome, in the classical style. Yes, he shall be an artist or a great architect. He has known it for as long as he has been alive, and despite his mother's illness, he has come to this place, this city of V, his destiny. It is his calling in the old-fashioned sense, in the romantic sense. Staggered by the grandeur and the glamour of the metropolis, the young man marvels, unable to see what is clearly evident. Nowhere else is the atmosphere of termination and exhaustion quite as palpable as here. In a charming way, of course. The palatial ruin he is feverishly drawn to, this elaborate staging of the dying empire. The Ringstrasse is beautiful. Its ornate facades, its proportions, its soaring light, its permanence, the sky a high Teutonic blue. He feels inside him a certain undeniable majesty. More than anything, he wants to make a lasting mark. And though his mother is mortally ill, the future is beautiful and it includes him in a beautiful way. He's heady with possibility. His box of paints, his charcoals, the smell of turpentine and linseed oil. It is a spring evening in 1908. The Ringstrasse is lit up in a blaze of new electric lights. The four rows of plane trees that border the boulevard have finally grown into trees. The smell of pine and sweet water waft. The Danube is a lovely gray blue under his arm, his latest portfolio. He sits with a small coterie of acquaintances pontificating as usual. Today he scoffs at Luz, the city's star architect. How he detests Luz, the flat, unornamented facade of his absurd building at the Michaelerplatz, directly opposite one of the Baroque portals of the Hofburg. Who has read, H. cries, Luz's scandalous article on the link between ornament and crime? He rises from his seat. The fool, he has no time for the so-called New Revolution architects. Ostentatious, his verdict, concealing flaws. Try to forgive his sudden, furious outbursts, his darkly brooding introspection, his fascination with death and revenge. A certain sorrow you are right to notice and rage more and more these days. Notice as well his madman glee, his huge schemes for public architecture, his designs for green space, his housing for the masses in small apartment units, his brainstorms, a plan for mass transit, his rehabilitation of his beloved village of El, his recipe for a new people's drink. All night he draws his plans, fueled by his brilliant, his beautiful dream of the way things can be. He is high-strung, arrogant, reserved, formal, aloof. He is restless, miserable, agitated, all longing, drawing, drawing, pacing, all dread, all hope, the bloated head. I believe in my success, he announces, and I believe in it unconditionally. One's cruel father, one's desperately ill mother, he is born to transcend such tedious, grim circumstances. He has been saved for something. He has been spared. Two brothers dead before his birth, one brother after him. He carries his drawings confidently to the Schillerplatz. People are intrigued by him, and though he is terrified of women, they are riveted, compelled by his conviction, his certainty, this erratic boy man prancing through the failing world, waiting for his life to begin. He wields his T-square like a sword. He is so filled with ambition, so filled with direction and passion, that he seems he can scarcely fail to achieve his goal. entry into V's Academy of Fine Arts. The entrance exam, he announces, shall be child's play. Tonight I see him at the opera with August, his friend. They shall be more than happy to stand. Before the curtain, a light supper is served, the gas lights are lit, the opera soon to begin. August Kubizek will later recall of his friend that his violence left him when listening to Wagner. And it is true, he has a genuine feel for the music. He can play Der Meistersinger on the piano with plenty of Liszt-ian fiatori. He knows it by heart. Tonight, he is caught again in the music. By the time the finale comes, he is in perfect spirits. All his worry gone, all his fears. He relishes every note clearly moved and that strange penetrating vibrato. No matter he knows nothing of Schoenberg or what the papers call the greatest uproar in V's concert hall in the memory of man, no matter he knows little of Webern or Berg, Mahler or Strauss, and though they are here, he has no use for them. Kokoschka, Klimt, Schiele, Wittgenstein, Otto Wagner, he laughs wildly. He dismisses them with a wave of the hand, the debased, degraded, unseemly. Mark, Clay, Kandinsky mean nothing to him, though they live in the same Schweiberg neighborhood. I have counted him at Lohengrin 10 times now, and at Tristan once a month for the past 5 years. He thinks of how he would render the scene given the chance. Oh, for a life of music and painting combined in the delirious world of opera. It's a beautiful day on the Ringstrasse, made more beautiful by the fact that the test results have been posted and young H is among those who have gained admission to the Academy of Fine Arts. See how the very world seems changed by this outcome. The day, like no other, is imbued with possibility and shape and space and light. Oh, the light in the light of the news. Young H walks with a great spring to his step, enormously heartened as if some tremendous burden has been lifted. What is this intimation? He shudders, then whistles a little tune. What is this feeling of having avoided something so horrendous he does not know how to describe it? The edges of his fear soften a little. Whatever it was is gone now. He walks into the cafe. He feels completely happy. A rose is on the table. He has been given the seal, the star, the go-ahead. Someone has looked upon his work and deemed it worthy. It's easy to see now, of course, that the line can be drawn clearly, his life before entrance into the academy and his life after. Look how it's made all the difference. He is appeased, elated. He returns to L to visit his mother and give her the news. He weeps for joy at her pride. He begs the doctors to spare her suffering, to save her life, and somehow for a little while she seems to recover. Yes, she does seem to improve some, and young H feels forever grateful and indebted. He returns to the city refreshed. It is the first day of art school, and the students are gathered at the academy's iron gate. The gate opens. He has gained entrance. He aligns and realigns the pencils in their case. He fusses with the latch. He wants to excel. He is pressed. Here there is rigor and purpose. Here there is kindness and guidance. This he could not have anticipated. His teacher devoted will shepherd him through the years. One could weep. It's not easy being young and wanting to be part of light and timelessness, that shining piece of paradise. See how his strangeness has left him. his emotions at last manageable, made legible by his devotion, by the eccentricity of his line, by the white page, so that he is merely restless now, excitable, given to bouts of melancholy, nothing more. His sorrows bearable at last. A dissatisfaction lingers, nothing more. Gone the obscenities, forgiven the betrayals. He enters the class of 1908 and takes an extraordinary turn away from the lesser pursuits and the less exalted world outside. He keeps chaos and catastrophe at bay in this community of aspiring ones. This time, God does not forsake him, but lives in him for moments, in the blue of the lamp he works by, in all he draws, a cup of blood, a brow, a cupola, an arch, a dragon's claw. Avoided, the friendlessness, the great hollow space, ties with nobody. Upon graduation, his art school friends remain steadfast, starving, in passionate pursuit of the elusive and beautiful. For what else is there? Let others waltz into the trenches, he mutters. Something far headier than even the Great War consumes him. Every night he paints, and in the day he makes images of the great city for postcards. It is no disgrace, young H., a modest postcard copyist. The studied brushstrokes in which every blade of grass is rendered, every stone in every wall, every roofing tile. It is not such a hardship painting pictures of landmarks and selling them to the local shops. Everyone, after all, must support themselves while doing a life's work. In the company of friends, he is not nearly so fearful, self-protective, weird. And when a young tourist moves to his side, admiring his work, he might speak with her or have a coffee or even one day take her hand. How soft her gloved hand. Somewhere the genius desire slips and he falls into a more modest, idiosyncratic private calling. Gone the inflated notions of the artist he once harbored. Each night now in front of the blank canvas, he is humbled. He lives the romantic life of an artist and finds a home of sorts in it, a structure, a solace, and is healed. Exchanging burnt umber for cadmium blue in the street with his friends, it is 1923, and he walks the city in reverie, unworried about what the rest of the world is worried about, exempt from it. Bolshevism, the national humiliation, what is it to him? He has kept it all in a kind of proportion, in the classical way. He is too good for the world. He aspires to other things, magnificence, permanence, eternity. Wars come and go, he says now, at the cafe among friends. The only lasting things are cultural values. Are not music and architecture the forces that will guide the footsteps of future generations? He becomes a painter of some note. He grows old. The early violent line has been tempered by age. He has attained a certain comfort level by painting utterly charming depictions of his world and of his beloved Tristan and Lohengrin, a goblet, a turret, a curtain, a torch. And then there are the portraits, not to forget the portraits. Preferring to work from photographs rather than living subjects, he has made a reputation as one who has an uncanny ability to memorialize the dead. There is something to be said for it, his life of portrait painting. Every hair on every head, he wins small but significant competitions. Tirelessly he paints. 6 million portraits would not be too many. What was aberrant in the young man, through praise and a small modicum of attention, has flurried remarkably into a kind of grace. He strolls along the Danube. He has been asked this afternoon to serve as a judge to choose the incoming class of the academy. He has, in his own way, become a man of the community. His opinion is respected, listened to, and despite his desire for privacy, he is flattered to have been included and will be happy to be a part of the selection process, remembering how once long ago in his own life it made all the difference. He is happy deep within. To him, it is not a modest success. His plans for redesigning the Capitol, done late into every night, were well regarded, and a few of his suggestions were taken. Each night still, he studies his small wooden model for L, the place of his birth. He has enjoyed his life somewhere at the periphery, in his garret, in the most decadent section of V. The bartering, the jugs of wine, the casual mistress, the years and years of peacetime since the Great War. He still makes the occasional pronouncements, of course. Recently, he's troubled by his city. The tone, particularly of V's anti-Semitic press, seems to be unworthy of the cultural traditions of a great nation. Yet somehow the city's impulses are contained. He has watched the papers carefully. He marvels and feels in them something momentous and gratifying about the way, despite everything, V and Germany swerved. When he listens to Wagner, he is exalted still. But the message he once heard in the libretto is tempered. Taken in context, he is now quite clear that Wagner is saying that the pursuit of power destroys love and leads to degradation and downfall. Anything else would be a distortion. It's quite obvious now. Resisted the adoration of barbarism, the loopy misreadings and oversimplifications of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, the delirious absolutes, good and evil, purity and corruption, rulers and ruled, the curse of gold, the inferior race grubbing underground, treachery, elitism, paganism, the bloody vapors. He smiles, opening his sketchbook. And after years of rendering in pencil on paper that deathbed scene, he is put into a different attitude to it. It is bearable in its odd way. He never thought he'd live long enough or work hard enough to get there. And then suddenly, mother. Though he knows otherwise, his work is perceived as mediocre. And so he has a feeling for those who are considered less than perfect. He sits drawing in the park. When sticks or stones are thrown, as they will be, even in times of peace, he shrugs, signing each painting A. Hitler in meticulous script. He whispers to himself, live and let live. In this, my one act of utter consequence, I, Ava Klein, waive the entrance exam results to the Academy of Fine Arts. It's irrational in a way. There is nothing at all to suggest there is anything but a modicum of talent. Still, there is no absolute way of knowing for sure. And as the dying possess a magic unlike anyone else on this earth, and as the dying are luminous and lucid and powerful in ways you cannot begin to imagine, I waive the test results and admit the sullen, arrogant boy as the 29th member of the incoming class of 1908. Run along then, young H, in peace to dream. And patting him on the head and handing him his portfolio and a new box of pencils and paints, I send him out into the city.